So, Gwyn, otherwise known as Tochiro on the boards, please tell us how your date with Kawamori went in the very romantic atmosphere of the Osamu Tezuka Museum.
You know, it was just me and the big K, and we had the VF1S by candlelight, some Kanoyoko playing softly in the background. And yeah, no. So I get to this night museum, and I caught the overnight bus down to Osaka and hung out in Denden Town, my first time to Denden Town, actually.
It was, yeah, really? You've never been there before?
No. I've always gone down to Osaka for an event. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, in and out. But this time...
I used to go there like almost like twice a week.
Wow.
Brings back memories. Yeah, because I used to live, you know, just a few stations away.
Well, this time...
Oh, you know what? Actually, yeah, side story. My wife's mother actually ran a business there. My wife's mother had... My mother-in-law now. She ran a franchise of manga kissa, which are like manga cafes. And so they had a bunch of stuff. And, you know, I could go over there, have lunch for free, and then just spend the rest of the day looking at mandarake, looking at all these Transformer toy shops. It was a really, really cool time. Sorry, please continue. This is about your life-changing experience.
Well, no, like I was saying, I used to do a bunch of one-day trips or quick overnight trips for events, or sometimes even for the odd baseball game, believe it or not. But this time I was being serenaded by Kawamori, so I made sure I checked the area out. But look, I went to these three events, and the signing session was a signing session, but there was some overlap between the talk show and what he said during the night museum. Not a lot, but some. And to start this from a kind of high-level overview, the more I hear about, from Kawamori himself, how he designs, the more I think a lot of his early VF1 design was happy coincidence. And the way he designs is very unique, very amazing, and is not the gritty, hardcore military mindset that a lot of Western fans seem to think he designs to.
Who are you talking about specifically?
No, it's just a lot of Western fans have mostly seen either the original Macross or Plus primarily, and they seem to think he's all about the realism and the grit and the detail. And it is true, he often uses real-life fighter planes as inspiration. But as I'll get to in a moment, he doesn't design with that in mind, at least initially. And I'm sure this is stuff you know, Renato, but...
Oh, yeah, I mean, like, for him... Like, he grew up with all these blocks and, you know, puzzle toys and stuff, and he liked making them into different shapes, moving joints around and stuff. So, for him, something that transforms or changes shape or has lots of gimmicks is something that is really fun, really creative and imaginative, and stimulates imagination as well. And I think that he just wants to put that in his shows, right? He wants to stimulate... thought. And, you know, depending on the setting, that can be in a serious comedy show, or it can be a serious comedy show, is that what I said? That can be in a serious sci-fi military show, or it can be in a funny comedy play oriented show, you know. The key concept is probably still the same, really, but there's no indication really that he ever wanted to just stick to one thing.
Right.
Especially not gritty, hardcore military drama, because that really, really does just create nothing but limitations on what you can do.
Agreed. And I'll get to some of that. Now, look, I've got two lists of points I was making, of notes, I should say. One was from the Night Museum, the other was from the talk show. And as always, these are going to seem as jumbled as the exhibit itself. Yay. They jump around all over the place because without doing a word for word translation, this is how notes from these kind of lectures and talks turn out. So, first of all, as we walked into the exhibit, Renato, you mentioned there was the area with the domes that had Lego Valkyries and the putty Grampus from Blue Submarine Number 6.
Yeah, yeah.
The first photo in that lineup was really interesting because it was something he designed pre Macross 7 for a project whose name, unfortunately, I didn't catch. But he was saying that it was a almost medieval looking Valk design. It was a mock up that was mostly made of blocks and paper. And
oh, I know what that was. Isn't that the Knights from the Sky thing?
It could have been. I didn't catch the name of it, but he was saying that, you know, the more he put detail into it, and the more he polished the design, the more medieval military and dragonish he got. So that ended up being Escaflowne. And the Valkyrie elements, like the wing placement and stuff, ended up going into the YF-19.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so that's the Seirang 99 QQQ core or something like that. I don't really know how you read it. Seirang 99 was the main mecha from Knights of the Sky, which there are many, many more designs that you can see if you go and check out that old book that we talked about that neither of us have on us right now, the Macross Design Works, right? So it's funny that they're in there since they're not technically a part of Macross. But like you said, yeah, it does relate to the pre-concept of
Of the 19.
Macross. So looking at, of the Macross 7 designs. So looking at the, also the VA3 Invader comes from there. It's straight up, just a very, very slightly remodeled design of one of the designs from that show. As does the Elgarzone, how do you pronounce that? The FZ10, whatever it is. Like the Verota Valkyrie, right? That comes from there too. So all of those have more kind of militaristic, almost World War II feel. And if this is something I was reading in the book as well, he goes into a bit more detail and he says that he found out that... you were saying that the more detail that you add, that it ends up being more like mythical and like medieval looking.
It's on this particular plane that he was designed.
Okay. Well, in general, in the book, he says that the more detail that you add, the more militaristic it begins to feel. And the less detail that you add, the more simple lines that you draw, the more sci-fi it begins to feel. So this was obviously a lot more detailed than his prior Macross stuff, but they were still transforming planes. So the way that he wanted to differentiate was just to make it a bit more detailed. But I guess at the end, they still didn't have enough of a difference, and so they ended up making it straight up Knights, which ended up being, of course, Escaflowne, right?
Speaking of which, there was no Escaflowne represented at this exhibit.
Because he wasn't the lead designer on that. Like, he was... he made the first design, which was this, basically, and then someone else made that.
Who was it that refined the Guy Mouse?
Good question. I don't know off the top of my head, I'm sorry.
Ah, no worries.
So, and it's not here because I don't have the book. But there's one more thing I want to say about this. Can I just really quickly?
Go
about
for
the Seirang. The Seirang, right? So if that's the reading, because it's in kanji, Seirang. The Seirang can transform into a plane, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you change the armor, it can also transform into a tank. If you look at page 18, there's what seem to be two robots, right? Well, there's three really, but. The one at the bottom doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Seirang, and then there's the Seirang with battle tank armor. And basically, you're just putting on what looks like armor parts on it, and then it can transform with those armor parts into a completely different vehicle. And it becomes a tank with a turret and everything. That's the same robot. Cool. Yeah, it doesn't look the same, but you can tell just because the forearms are the same. The forearms are the only parts that still remain from the original robot.
The point on the head.
A little bit of the head, maybe, yeah. But even then, he's wearing a different helmet.
Well, since we're just walking through this exhibit, and, it was 20 of us and Kawamori, and, we could gets close to him, he encouraged questions at any point. A lot of people, myself included, were really kind of hesitant because you don't want to ask something that's really obvious and dumb that everyone knows. And if you ask something, if you ask something that's too detailed, you worry then he'll get into really detailed and technical explanations, which will go way over your head and run out of time. But anyways, we moved on to the Aquarian stuff, and briefly, he had one comment about the Aquarian stuff in particular that made me chuckle, and that was, you know how you have the three vectors, right? And each one was after, well, one was the moon, one was the sun, one was a star, and those preliminary designs, which were at the exhibit, the pitch designs from before the project got greenlit, looked far more obviously like a moon, a sun, and a star.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the sun one, you know, it was basically a round glowing thing behind the aquarium, almost like a, not like a Christian halo, but like a, like an aura that's behind a Buddha, you know what I mean?
And the moon vector was very much like, you know, a crescent moon.
Yes, with
a fire, you know. And they were so different to the way the designs finally turned out. And he mentioned that, you know, he was doing this pitch document for Aquarian. He said, yeah, these will, you know, join together into giant robot. He had given zero thought into how that would actually work when he pitched the project. But he gave these designs over, and then he's like, well, I'll worry about it if it gets greenlit. And it got greenlit, so he's like, oh, crap, now I have to make these things form into a robot. Which could be why it doesn't stand very well, Renato.
Well, I don't know. I think he worked on it for a while. It wasn't like,
oh,
I have to do it now.
Well, once it got
took
approved.
At least a year.
Yeah, once it got approved. But initially, that, you know, it was something he wanted to do, but he hadn't given any thought about how they designed it all initially, which kind of struck me as funny. So we were
What do you think, just very quickly, what do you think about the Aquarian design just overall?
It's too, like, how do you mean? Like, do I like
it? I think
it,
it's,
or?
I mean, I, well, the concept is that it's three things together, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's more triangle than Micro Frontier, in my opinion. So I think they could have integrated those three robots much better, because at the end of the day, you've got, in whatever robot it is that you make, it's a robot with a pair of legs sticking out at the back. And you don't really need those pair of legs sticking out. You can just make it two robots combined, which I think they finally admit in this third iteration of Aquarium that's airing right now, Aquarium Logos, because you just have two robots combining.
Hmm.
So they leave out the third. They just said, well, we didn't really need it anyway. If you have the toy, some of the combinations can actually be made with just two robots. It's, and in fact, sometimes I leave out the third robot just because otherwise it can't stand up. So it's kind of, I felt it was a cop-out, really. But, yeah, that's just me. In terms of design.
Well, I've always been a bigger fan of the concept of Aquarian rather than...
Yeah, me too.
The way it's actually been realized, whether it be the design of the robot or the story. The robot has its roots far too much in Super Robot, and I've never been a huge Super Robot fan. That's not something I grew up with. I was always more of a... And I hate this term, but a real robot fan, you know. And the only reason we use that term is to differentiate everything that isn't giant, almost magically powered with infinite punches and rocket punches.
You do know that it doesn't matter now what we have talked about up until this point for the hour and a half that this has been going on for, or what we will talk about afterwards. Every single comment, if any, that is made on this podcast is going to be about, well, I think real robot, no, no, well, that's a super robot. You know. You just know.
Well, we moved on then to the VF1 design. And this is where I first started getting this sense of how he designed. He discussed, first of all, and I'm sure, again, you know this, and I'll probably say that quite often. When he first, well, ostensibly, pretty much interned, you know, when he was helping out Studio Nue as a student, he was introduced to this concept of designing by silhouette. In that if a robot cannot be distinguished at a glance by its silhouette, it's a failure.
Yeah, something which Michael Bay never learned.
Exactly. So many things that he'll put into, especially his early designs, were there to make it, to give it a distinctive silhouette, right? For example, with the VF1, those legs in Batroid mode, without those stabilizer fins on the legs, those legs are just a straight line going from the ankle all the way up to the nose cone. And while those stabilizers did work out as being there as a piece of the plane, initially he added them in because it gave a more distinctive silhouette in the legs. That was one of several things. The head lasers were another thing. Not only did they help the viewer, you know, distinguish between what version of Valkyrie they were looking at, but he needed something to distinguish the head. This is something that had been done in Super Robots for, you know, a decade before Macross, if not longer. You look at Mazinga and how every Mazinga has a different shaped, whether it be wing-looking things or spikes or helmet-looking things on its head. None of them serve any purpose except to give the robot a more distinctive silhouette. So he put these spikes on the head of the VF-1, and then he worked the concept into it being actual, you know, head lasers. Similar to the lights on the shoulders. Yeah. If you're looking at this, especially in those early Takani illustrations, those lights, like, wow, he's got lights on the shoulders so it can be seen, and it's also realistic. It's like, well, no, I just want something there that was unique. Otherwise, the shoulders would look like half a dozen other transforming robot shoulders.
Right.
So I'm getting this sense from this early point of this talk that, yes, when it all comes together, it looks very realistic. It looks based in real world, and that's what people take away from it because they're seeing the final product. But his thought process, his design process, is very much based on aesthetics, on silhouette, and on really the practicalities of the medium he's working with.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know what would make it probably easier to understand, unless I screw up the explanation? Batman, right? Clearly, the Batman silhouette is so iconic that you can just draw it with one line and everyone knows what you've drawn, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the new movies, right, it's all explained that this is armor and this is that and this is this, you know? Right. And this is a special weapon. So, like, the fins on his forearms are a special military weapon or whatever it was. Christopher Nolan, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, that's what it is. It's basically adding the real world explanation after the fact. It's basically what you've described, right?
Right.
So I have the aesthetic thing that is going to make it recognizable, and then make up some real world excuse for it later on. In fact, giant robots themselves, we know, are not realistic, right? So why even bother having them in the show? Well, that's why they made the aliens giants as well, so they could fight, mm-hmm. and that's why humanity would need to develop giant humanoid robots. So everything is made up afterwards as an excuse.
And this ties back into what you mentioned about the Delta art last podcast, Renato, how he's already come up with an in-world excuse for those different engine trails.
Yeah, but it's just an excuse. It doesn't, I mean, I'm not saying to devalue it or anything like that, but visual design cues come first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
Entertainment comes first.
Well, yeah, he made the point that if that, yeah, as I said, the robot is not easily distinguishable by the viewer at a single glance, scrapped, do the silhouette from scratch, then work out how it works as a robot. With regards to the VF-0, he did mention the challenge of having fuel tanks on that thing, because, of course, this is an example of the setting, the world, influencing the design, in that it's a pain in the butt to work out where to add fuel tanks, but according to the setting, they don't have the reaction motors or whatever yet, engines in the Valks. Yeah. So he had to work out a way to store fuel. And, you know, they are those things where when it's in fighter mode, those tanks on the back that are half embedded into the back.
Yeah.
But he did mention that, you know, the only problem that this presents is that when it transforms, those things have to be able to snap in half, for starters.
Yeah, yeah.
And it means that you've got two halves of a fuel tank strapped to your chest in Batroid mode, so you could get blown up pretty easy.
Yeah, I always thought that was kind of weird.
I think it sounded like this was an example of the setting influencing his design in a way that wasn't organic to his process, which was
really... So is he saying that that's a failure, basically? Because at the end of the day, it is a weird design.
Right. Well, he didn't go out, like, you know, and say the word failure, but he just mentioned it was kind of strange.
Because that's what it looks like to me. Those fuel tanks are snapping in half.
Mm-hmm.
Which renders them basically useless. I mean, what is going on there? With
Well, we got sidetracked for a moment there because some guy at the back of this 20-person group yelled out, "You know, it really seems that you like canards."
Okay.
And he went into a canard discussion for about 5 minutes. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, he definitely likes them on the VF-0D. They're everywhere.
Exactly. With Armored Core, some really interesting comments he made about designing from the back. In that Armored Core presented a challenge to him. He realized he had to put more design into the back of the robots because that's what the player is looking at the
exactly,
whole time.
Exactly, yeah.
So most of those designs that you said were really overly detailed and started to look similar, many of those were from the back, which
yeah,
is why they look quite boring, but that's because that's what the player is going to be looking at. And he said that when designing Armored Core mechs, he came up with the idea of they're like sports cars. And at first I was like, wait, they're all big chunky tank things based on a core system where you swap parts out and it's very, very, just very chunky, very utilitarian.
Very like hodgepodge as well.
Right. It's like, where do you get the sports car analogy? He was like, well, like a sports car, the whole idea of sports cars is that they overtake you. So you see them from the rear most of the time. As such, from a design perspective, he finds sports cars are design heavy in the back. Similarly, for Armored Core mechs, you have to focus on designing the back of them because that's what people are looking at all the time. Yeah. The idea for this core system was something he came up with because From Software, and this is going back to 1997, wanted something original to distinguish the game because if you remember, Renato, the PlayStation 1 had been out for a year or so, and suddenly everyone realized, well, we can make these 3D polygon games for home consoles, and there are all these early, quite poorly done, some very experimental, like 3D games, right? Robots as polygons, most of which don't age well. And they want a way to distinguish themselves from this rush of robot games.
I've got one right here in front of me. Have you ever heard of Love and Destroy? Love and Destroy is a robot game which has character designs by... I forgot his name. Katsura Masakazu.
What else
is the guy at the Video Girl Eye.
Okay, I know the game. Yeah, I actually have that game.
Do you?
Yep.
Love and Destroy. It's the most uncontrollable game I've ever played.
I had it in university, and I got it just for the character designs. I didn't really care that there was a robot in it.
I got it for 100 yen.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those early games.
Right. Well, they were trying to,
No, it's not. 99.
Oh, wow.
They should have known better. They should have known way better by that point.
Does it say who made it on the cover?
Arc Entertainment.
Oh.
I don't know what they've done.
Yeah.
ARC.
All right, well...
Actually, ARC... Arc Entertainment is a trademark of Sony Computer Entertainment, apparently.
So it could be an internal studio.
In-house?
Hmm.
I don't know. Well, anyway.
So, well, speaking of studios, he mentioned that From Software... And keep in mind, it's been a while since From Software has done an Armored Core game. They're mostly known for the Dark Souls stuff these days, right?
Yeah, well, and Ace. Another Centuries episode.
Oh, when was the last Ace game? That was a while ago.
I don't know. It was on the PSP, actually, last one. Because it had laser in it.
Yeah, but it's still a while back.
I guess.
I'm just saying, they've done a lot of games.
That's what they've done with robots.
Right. I think for robots, they're most well known for the Armored Core stuff, but as of late, they're just going from strength to strength with these Souls games, which are really popular. And they're completely different.
Yes.
But this was where they made their mark with Armored Core. And the thing is, even with the first Armored Core, From Software had kind of a reputation, from a user perspective, of making B-grade games. Like, they were quirky, they were fun if they were your thing, but they were always kind of glitchy, had some weird control schemes. Like, Armored Core, you use the back buttons on the PlayStation controller to look up and down. It was just really bad design. But he said they worked incredibly fast. Most companies at the...
Well,
there you go. most companies, he said, would take one of his designs and it would take a month or more to make a 3D model of it. But he said he'd give From Software a design. And granted, I'm sure this is partly because it was all modular. But he said they would have a controllable prototype done within a week. And they'd be like, come on down to the studio, play around with it. Now, I'm sure that's just in a test environment. It wouldn't have been in-game. But given the era we're talking about here and how early the PS1 was, that was pretty impressive. And he was saying they were really good to work with. So moving on, this brought him on to talking about CG robots, because they had playing, if you noticed, the opening for one of the more recent Armored Cores on a TV.
Yeah.
Right near all the designs. And he mentioned, and he came back to this later on, about the problem with heads and faces for CG robots, because everything's in CG. And he comes from this background of design for silhouette, but he finds that CG robot heads are just hard to make distinguishable. They all kind of start to look samey because everyone can put the same level of design with minimal effort now.
Yeah.
So he tends to go overboard with detail to try to distinguish his designs. And I'm just thinking, yep, look at Aquarian. Look at all the useless detail in that face. That is exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah. Well, speaking of detail, actually, that reminded me of one very interesting thing that I thought. If not, it might have been the most interesting thing at the exhibition, which is why I forgot about it. It has to do with detail. When you are designing something that is supposed to be for a hand-drawn anime, there are always limitations on how many lines you can make a design with, and how, because it has to be replicated by animators by hand for each frame, right? Pre-CGI rather. And when he was working on Crusher Joe in 1983, and he was sitting next to Yasuhiko, you know, from Gundam, he was designing the spaceship. What's the name of the spaceship? Cordoba or something?
They had the design sketches for it there, didn't they?
The Cordoba, yeah. They had the design sketches, but also did you notice that all across, like diagonally across the ceiling, there was a kind of blown up roll of film which had the Cordoba coming into frame and then going out of frame.
Oh yeah.
So what he had done was he was sitting next to, hang on, someone's calling me on Skype. He was sitting next to Yasuhiko, and the director comes over to him and says, "All right, design this thing. Don't worry, you can make as many lines on it as you want." Whereas usually there would be a limit, like, you know, if you ever compare the YF-19 with the VF-19, you know that Actually, you know what? Forget about that. So usually there'd be a limit, but he was like, "Okay, draw it with as many lines as you want. I don't mind. Do a design." And so he does it, and it's superbly detailed. Like, he went overboard there with detail as well. And so he comes back and he says, "Okay, you know what? You're animating this with all this detail. Only you can draw it. So you better get ready, man. Sleepless nights ahead of you." And so that roll of film is his animation. He actually drew the keyframes and the in-between frames for that. So he didn't just do the design. He literally drew those frames that you see in the movie as it goes past the camera.
And those are replicated in the book, too.
Yeah, they're in the book. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Page 7, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to apologize to any listeners still with us for continuing to reference a book that's not available in shops.
You can imagine it.
Or you can go watch Crusher Joe. I mean, hey, everyone wins.
Well, we're going to get... I mean, it's in Crusher Joe. You can just see the ship coming towards the camera, and then it goes out of frame. So, you know, I was just impressed with the way that he lends himself so well to a brand new format, because prior to that, I'd never heard about him having tried any animation or anything like that, you know, his strength, I thought, was in design work and figuring out how things move in the real world, maybe, but not how to represent that in a 2D drawing.
Mm.
You know, that motion in 2D drawing. Because it's actually a complicated sequence. There's lots of foreshortening going on and depth changing.
Right. No, yeah, certainly. And so, he really did super detail that ship. I mean, there's so many gun turrets and most of them seem unnecessary.
Yeah. Like, if it seems like... if it's not making sense what I'm saying, the job of an animator is completely different to the job of a designer. It's not the same thing. Just because you can do one doesn't mean you can do the other.
Hmm. Well, look... so that's the bulk of my notes from the actual night at the museum. Although, you know, we had a Q&A session and I talked to him a bit about influences of real-life planes on him. Now, keep in mind, this is before the Draken reveal for Delta. And he was actually saying, it was funny in hindsight hearing this, that he didn't really look to planes for inspiration anymore. And in hindsight, I realized he meant modern military fighters. Because he said with the advent of stealth technology, everyone has, you know, the basic same silhouettes, the same kind of designs, and they're not very distinguishable. You know? Yeah.
Which and he repeated that in the talk show.
Right. And which is why he ended up going back to a plane from, you know, 50-odd years ago.
Yeah.
And it's funny because there's two opinions of thought then on that plane. You know, some people who know their planes are like, well, it's the Draken, he's basing this on reality, Macross continues to be kind of gritty, and then you think about it, it's like, wait, why would he base a Valk on a 50-year-old Earth plane? Well, it's because modern planes are not inspirational or really usable, so this is not being influenced from a military gritty realism standpoint. This is being influenced purely from an aesthetic standpoint, and he wants something that's visually recognizable.
Yeah, so again, it's about...
it's about the silhouette. Design.
Yeah.
Really. And he said, you know, as far as silhouettes go, he was like, okay, look at the 27, look at the 51. It's like they all, you know, stand out very well. In fact, in the talk show that he did later, he brought up silhouettes of all these Valkyries on a slide and showed how they're all, even in just fighter mode, easily distinguishable if you knew your Valkyries.
Yes.
So I talked to him a bit about that, but moving on, the following day we had the signing and the talk show. And the talk show, a lot of this information can be found in that book he did recently. What was it? The Visionary Creator.
Well, that was a couple of years ago too now.
Right, but it is the most recent book he's brought out.
Is it?
Yeah. And I think a lot of people didn't pick it up because it's, you know, a lot of text. It's very text heavy. But that book does go into a lot of detail on, you know, his thoughts regarding design. And he said himself that a lot of what he said was kind of cribbed from the book. It was an 80-minute lecture, and some of the points that stood out to me, he spoke a lot about influences when he was growing up. And you've actually already mentioned a few of these, Renato, and I'm sure these aren't, you know, majorly new information. The Thunderbirds influence, I know we've spoken about mm-hmm. before. And how he's overjoyed to be working on Thunderbirds now because it had such an influence on him growing up. He said one of the things was the Thunderbird 2. And the Thunderbird 2, well, the big green one with the container in the middle, right?
Yes.
It's an easy way of, you know, explaining it. I was never a big Thunderbirds fan myself. Later on, when talking about the Thunderbird 2, he did say, well, look at the silhouette of that. Look at all the Thunderbirds, how easily recognizable they are. That's pretty much very similar to Nuer design philosophy.
Yes.
And he said the idea of the Thunderbird 2, of having a gimmick included in it, which was a part of the design, in this case, the cargo pods, but is not really hidden, but it's incorporated. He said it's kind of like a half-hidden design feature was something that influenced him with things like the 29 design with the pop-up turrets. Like, he designed it so that they fit into the design, but they're not completely hidden. There's no doors hiding them. They're obviously there, but they're kind of submerged, then they're sunk in, then they pop up kind of thing. He said that was influenced by the Thunderbird too. But as a kid, you know, he loved Thunderbirds, and he designed his own out of paper. He made his own Thunderbird 2 mold out of paper. Why? As a kid, he had this idea that this weird idea that if he built a model, he was cheating. He would have lost. It's like all you do with a model is put it together. There's no creativity in it. If you're a fan, you build it out of paper. Of course, this is before the age of VCRs, so with no reference material except remembering what he remembered from the show, he forgot the details of the design anyway. So he went into a toy shop, opened the box of a model kit, and looked at the design, and then went back and made his paper version. But even as a kid, he said his entire life he's only ever actually made to completion two or three plastic models. Because he just doesn't see the point. As a kid, he made them with paper. And that familiarity with papercraft then ties into what we often see with his Lego Valks, how he has paper bits stuck under them to kind of elaborate on the design.
Yeah.
The other thing that influenced him was, of course...
He said, with the papercraft thing, because there's an interview at the back of the book where he goes into detail about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, for the papercraft things that he used to make... He used to make them one a day.
Wow.
He would, and that's the way that he would refine his designs as well. That's why he wanted to. It's basically trial and error. How to make it cooler, how to make it more effective, how to make it more efficient.
Is this the book I was referring to as the viewpoint of a vision?
No, this book right now. This book that we have in our
hands. The back of the exhibition book. Okay. So the book I was referring to was the English title, such as it was the viewpoint of a vision creator.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Just if anyone wants to look it up.
Yeah.
Also, the Apollo missions, he said he was watching on TV, and even as a kid, he was just like, damn it, how dare these people get to space before me? And he said that kind of really inspired him. And the way the modules of the rockets worked... To him, that was the first idea he had of Gattai, of transformation, of combining. So the Apollo rocket design kind of sparked in him, at least partially, this idea of change and combining designs. The other thing that informed him was these blocks that his parents bought him, which weren't Lego, they were some other brand, but they only ever bought him...
That's Fisher or something, right? It's not Fisher Price, it's...
It's some other...
Fisher Technic is what it's called.
Well, his parents only ever bought him the base kit because they were apparently not cheap. And he said he had all these ideas for things he wanted to design as a kid and build, but he didn't have enough blocks. So he would start to try to build things that could transform so he'd get more toys out of the blocks.
Right. More because those blocks had a special kind of joint system where you could slide them around and rotate them. According to, again, the back of this book.
Well, it sounds like he's cribbed a lot from that book for this as well.
Yeah, yeah.
There's also the story where...
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, though.
Well, there was also a story he gave where, as a kid driving home one night, there was a car. I've forgotten whether it was just in front... Oh, it was parked in the driveway next to them or something. And it was a European import. It was a non-mass-produced model. It was like a custom model. And it was really a really nice... luxurious car with great design, and his father apparently said to him, yep, that's a European design, like compared to Japanese cars, which are kind of nondescript. And he said that's the first time he'd ever had a notion of the word design, and it immediately sparked this thing. He wanted to know like what it was and how it could make this difference, like what he was feeling looking at this detail. He mentioned briefly the manga he did with Saishu no Senshi or Saishu Senshi.
I think it was Saishu Senshi. I don't think there's a no in the...
Memory. Yeah.
It's in perfect memory, right?
Yeah. They've got like a couple pages. He mentioned that briefly. Talked about very briefly meeting Mikimoto and... Yeah. Was it Onogi, who was also in college with him? Was it?
I think so, yeah.
And then said, you know, once he started hanging out at Studio Nue... He pretty much went straight into working. So he's never actually had to write a resume or go job hunting. He went straight from being an amateur kind of a fan to working to being professional with no real job hunting process. Now, one of the best parts about this talk show, he talked about his design philosophies and what influenced them. And it was really fascinating. He pulled out a whiteboard and drew these two big lists. And it was the difference between design for fiction and design for actual real-world use. So, like, fiction versus reality. Because he designs both, as we discussed. It's things like the Ibo design, you know.
Yeah.
As opposed to an Aquarian design. Speaking of which, going back to the Ibo, he did say that a lot of those things that he had thought of, gimmicks and transformation bits and different designs, were basically because this had to be something that was industrially sturdy and rugged, and any sort of indentation or hole in the device was yet another opportunity for people to cut their finger or hurt themselves or come up with some excuse to sue Sony. So they wanted it to be as sleek and simple as possible. The one thing they did let him do was apparently he ended up thinning, putting notches in the side of the body so you could reach down with one hand and grip it and pick it up. And that was because it kept falling downstairs. So this way it wasn't, because it was a slippery, this slippery smooth with no breaks in it of the surface of the body. So people were having trouble picking it up. So he reworked that, but that's a tangent. So yeah, when looking at fictional design, he was talking about things you had to look at, you know, the setting of the show of what it was for, the world. If the world exists, that's going to influence the design. If the world doesn't exist, he may well have to think of one to inform the design. In reality, he's got to think of cost performance, you know, and physically whether it will work. You know, in fiction, he's thinking of fashion, of characters, of the characteristics of the mech, of a sense of character. In reality, he's thinking of the actual size of it. Corporate identity of whoever's hired him to make it, what they want to represent themselves as, their public image, you know. For fiction, he's looking at these design elements. Is it fantasy? Is it real life? Is it steampunk? Is it ancient Japan? You know, what is the motif of the design? Is there dragons in it, like Escaflowne? Does it have to have some kind of dragon design worked into it? Regulations affected both fiction and reality. Whether it was regulations for something like Ibo, where they had to stop people from hurting themselves, or whether he had to come up with regulations and race rules for something like Cyber Formula, which informed how many gimmicks and how radical he could make the car design, or how real to life he had to make them. Something you mentioned before, Renato, he brought up, was the effect of the end medium on design from the very beginning. You know, is it hand-drawn? Is it CG? Is it a video game? Is it anime? If so, is it TV or a movie? How many frames do you have? Does it have to be easily replicable by hand? Which, he said, the VF1 was designed so that you could draw it quickly. And he pulled up a whiteboard and quickly drew a VF1. And he's like, this had to be done over and over, and that partly informed the simplicity of the lines and where we put the gimmicks to make the silhouette stand out.
Wow, it sounds like this was a really, really concise but really packed crash course in Kawamorology.
You know, it was. He said the original speech, the lecture he designed, was for 90 minutes. We had 80 minutes, but they included, like, you know, getting started and Q&A. So he was really cramming it in. It was a really dense talk. It was really good. He again talked a bit about CG and how everyone, like, mecha in CG are starting to look samey because everyone can easily do a standard level of detail, which is acceptable. And that as a result, he'd start hyper detailing stuff. Things that, you know, is this product, is this design going to be a toy? I'm sorry about Aquarian, but, you know, is it going to be a toy? Can it be handled easily? Can it be turned into a toy easily? Is there a sense of character? He said that making a hero mech, or, you know, for example, Alto's Valkyrie, a hero mecha was 20 times more difficult, in his opinion, than designing cannon fodder. Because not only does it have to have the distinguishable silhouette, it has to project the sense of character. You know, how does this mecha represent the character? How is it the character's identity shown here. And as he's saying this, you know, it came all back around to the silhouette theory, and I'm just thinking, this is as opposed to gritty, realistic military design as you can get. These are all really important considerations. And as you said, I think they inform so much of his design, and then details are kind of laid over the top as they can be. It was just really interesting because nowhere was he mentioning all these. You know, I'm going to look at real life planes. I'm going to see how many canards or intake vents or whatever. None of that even came into the equation he was talking about here. He talked about the problem with hips on robot designs. And this is a story that's not particularly new, but how in the 70s through the early 80s, humanoid, most robots, especially Gundams, were humanoid in shape, therefore had to have hips.
Yes.
For the legs, and that pretty much informed how they could move, and they started to look quite samey. And that this was one of the drivers behind designing the Regolt, and of course, eventually, like the Gerwalks. And how, of course, Batroids have no hips, really. So, thereby, he bypassed the whole problem.
Yeah, so Miyatake, in the translation from the Orgus toy interview that I did recently, he describes that as every robot up until the Valkyrie basically wore pants. Was wearing underpants.
A skirt. Yeah. He was wearing a skirt in the case of Gundam. Those dangly bits around the waist.
And if you think about that, that limits what you can do with the transformation. But once those joints were freed up by simply just having legs that rotate around an axis on the side of the groin, basically, then you can do so much more with transformation than ever before. And that's the reason why the Valkyrie transformation works. Yeah, so I remember seeing a Japanese comment on the Valkyrie design. This is a few years back. It was Nichanel or something like that, 2chan. And someone said, I don't know if... you might need to censor this. He said, oh yeah, that was... The Valkyrie was the first robot I thought, hey, that robot has a... In Japanese, of course, he wrote that. So, you know, I actually thought that too. Because I did grow up with, a little bit, with, you know, Tetsujin and Mazinger and stuff like that. Those were on TV at the same time. And Macross, and Transformers, of course, like, they all wear pants too. They have skirts. And Macross was the only one that didn't. And it looked really weird. At the time. The way those legs moved, you know?
And with Gundam, Tomino is at the Okawara exhibit.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting things they had there was initial designs for the
F-91. Oh, okay.
And how you had Okawara's original design, and Tomino had come in and...
Oh, basically, I saw that. Yeah,
they put red ink. He had red ink all over the design.
All over the design. Right? I remember seeing that, because I went there with my wife, and I remember saying, yeah, that Tomino, he's gone over and done, make this like this, make this like that, make the do this.
Oh, it's in like the book, too.
Teacher.
It's not a full page, unfortunately, but it's in the book, and, you know, things like reduce the size of the backpack. Don't want this much detail here. Legs need to be thicker down the bottom. Hello, 70s design aesthetic. But he had a specific note saying the skirt needs to be longer. The skirt on the waist is too short. By which he meant those metal plates that all Gundams have. So that was kind of interesting.
Well, actually, can I just say about the skirt thing with the Okawara exhibit?
Mm-hmm.
Because I had just, or maybe I was in the middle still, of translating that Kazutaka Miyatake interview, where he talks about, you know, getting rid of the skirt armor, basically. It was fresh on my mind when I went to see this Okawara exhibit. And Dagram was 1980, right? It came out in 81, I think, but it was in pre-production in 1980, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was still 81 during the design phase, it was still before Macross. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So... there are preliminary designs for Dagram which don't have the skirt. and they're very like just the hips, they're quite Orgus-like. It was on that wall. I remember, because this thing was fresh in my memory, what Miyataka was talking about. They said he had the first, or rather Studio Nue had the first non-skirt robot design that freed up everything for transformation, freed up everything for posing and stuff like that. And here I was looking at this design from 80 or 81 by Okawara, and he'd done it, but then had changed it into a skirted design for the final show. Probably because, I guess, I don't know, what's his name? Takahashi Ryosuke decided he wanted to go in that direction. So that was interesting.
Well, one other thing, and I'm pretty much at the end of my notes here, but Kawamori also briefly touched on how his experience helping out with Ulysses 31.
Oh, yay!
I know, it's right, I want to mention this. How that influenced his decision to put an entire city into the Macross. Now, I know you touched in some lecture or something you did at some point on the Ulysses 31 connection. Did you want to
In fact,
that?
I spoke about that last week, too. On Wednesday, in a lecture. Yeah.
Well, if no one in Japan remembers Cobra, then surely they're not going to remember Ulysses.
Oh, no, no, no. Well, it barely came out. All the, like, at the time when it was being made and aired in France, Animage and magazines like that were actually writing articles about it, but they never actually aired it in full until the 90s on NHK. And, of course, it didn't go down very well, because by that point it was old, and just, like, the format didn't fit well with what was in at that point. Anyway... so this goes way back, though. This is from a book called Do You Remember, if I remember correctly? Oboite Masuka. Not I Oboite Masuka. Not Do You Remember Love. It's just Do You Remember, which is one of those Animage Bunko small books, which is basically just a bunch of pictures from Do You Remember Love. But towards the end, there's a really in-depth interview with Kawamori. And this is from 84, 85, something like that, where he talks about what he wanted to do with Ulysses 31. You know, obviously not the whole thing, but I mean, one section of this interview is about Ulysses 31. And again, he talks about similar things in the latest book that we were talking about, the viewpoint of a vision creator, right? So one of the things he wanted to do in Ulysses 31 was... to have a tube-type train system going around a glass dome out of which skyscrapers would pop out, you know, and have that inside the spaceship. Each and every single one of those ideas was shot down by the producers, those dicks, of Ulysses 31. And he was always so frustrated about it. They also told him, yeah, you can't make these spaceships too pointy because otherwise, you know, kids are going to get scared because it's too violent or something. And it's like, it's a weapon of war in space. Of course it's supposed to be pointy. Anyway, aren't you guys the guys who designed the Concorde? And then, of course, 10, 15 years later, he's put everything that he wrote out of, or that was written out of, that into Macross 7. So 7 did it eventually. Again. And that kind of goes back to the X-Bomber thing as well, because there's a lot of design things that never made it into X-Bomber, and so those preliminary designs that were behind the glass case there were about this moon base thing that again had another dome on top of it. It was some other stuff that I can't remember anymore, and we weren't allowed to take photographs, and it's not in the book, so now it's just a figment of my imagination. But there's a whole lot of stuff that, you know, that once Kawamori gets told you can't do this, he's saving it somewhere. And will use it eventually for something else. That's why he never really talks about stuff that he's been told not to do. In fact, he's gone out, I don't remember where, but in some interview, maybe written or maybe in a talk show, he said, yeah, I had all these ideas, but I'm not going to talk about them now because I might want to bring them out later on, you know, in 5 years, 10 years maybe. So, you know, he's putting all this stuff in reserve.
Yeah. Well, he did say something then that brings that back around, Renato, but before I mention that, regarding... like ship design, he did mention the design of the what do you call it? The appendage ships in the frontier fleet, like the islands. Sorry, you know how they spread out. And he said those were specifically designed to look like, and I think in Japanese he called them vinyl houses. Basically, you know the plastic. Well, the plastic greenhouses as opposed to glass. As in, they're very temporary. They look like there's, and they look like they have a frame with, you know, something clear stretched over them, and they were supposed to give you this visual impression of weakness, that these things could be blown over any time, and that they could well be temporary, and that, you know, in the show they did get, you know, messed up or separated from the fleet or blown up, and that that he was trying to project this sense of, you know, these are temporary things, they're housing greenery or prisons or whatever, and they're only supposed to last a certain amount of time and could be destroyed at a strong gust of wind. You know, and those are things we see quite often here if you live anywhere outside of the city. You know, they're everywhere in fields and stuff.
Yeah, they're in allotments.
But speaking of reusing designs, he finally, one of the points he mentioned that I wanted to bring up was one of his aquarium vector designs, I think it was the sun one, the final one he ended up using, he designed that more or less when he was in elementary school. It was just some random plane design he'd come up with.
Which one is this?
One of the vectors in the original aquarium.
Really?
He didn't say which one.
He didn't say which one.
But he said he'd come up with a design in elementary school. So talk about holding onto your designs until you can reuse them.
It's half a century.
Exactly.
All right, so thank you very much for that walkthrough of the walkthrough. So, shall we do final impressions on what we thought of the exhibition overall?
No, sure. I mean, do you want to go first?
Yes. But I will say that I already basically talked about this at the Firebomb Bar. So, you know, it might be repeating a little bit. But this is what I thought. I didn't think that this exhibition was particularly accessible to regular people, like the general public. Even though it was in this this area, which is Osamu Tezuka, right? This Osamu Tezuka Museum, everyone knows who he is. And then if you were a regular guy learning about Osamu Tezuka, going, oh, wow, that guy is amazing, and then you climb the stairs, and then you're suddenly in robot world with no context whatsoever, you are just going to be confused. And I saw many people. Look, okay, first of all, when I went there, there were very few people, just because it was the middle of the week. But most people were just walking straight through that part. The other people who went to the museum were there to check out the Tezuka stuff, which is permanent exhibition, so it's not like they were rushing to get there or anything. But they, most people, I say, didn't really care about the whole Kawamori stuff. At least no one was there for 5 hours like I was.
I came across that a few times as well, especially near the opening. You get kids sprinting up the stairs, having just gone through all the Tezuka stuff, and they'd be like, Macross? What's Macross?
And the difference is that this exhibition is specifically focusing on robots and transforming mecha, right? It's not really about Kawamori. And if they had treated Kawamori in the same way that they approached Tezuka, as in, where did he grow up, what were his backgrounds, what were his influences, you know, photos from his childhood or whatever, I think maybe people would be a bit more interested into how it was that he came into doing this line of work, how influential this work was on the rest of the anime and manga industry. Well, I mean, not so much manga, but at least like toys, you know, robot design as a whole. I felt it was a bit of a wasted opportunity. Given the limited space and the limited scope of what they wanted to do, I can understand that they want to just focus on, a cross-section of his work on robots, and of course he is an anime director and has done lots of other stuff that doesn't have anything to do with robots, like Arjuna or like Night on the Galactic Railroad, the Kenji Miyazawa movie, right? Mm-hmm. What's it called? Spring of Kenji no Haru, right? Ihatobu. So there is that aspect to him, and of course this exhibition is not going to contain all of that. So I can understand why they would want to focus on one part. But even then, the whole spewing of endless similar-looking robot designs from floor to ceiling is overkill to someone who has absolutely no frame of reference as to why this would be remotely important. I just felt like, at the end of the day, Kalmore himself ended up appearing almost like a robot. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't seem to have a soul, whereas he's supposed to have this creator spirit. He's supposed to channel that.
I can't disagree more, but then again, I agree in terms of the overall exhibit. Yeah, in terms of the overall exhibit, if you don't have the insight or, you know, the talk show or that kind of thing, I can see where you're coming from.
Even the book, like, you open the book and they've made some effort, but it's so minimal that it doesn't really work because, for example, the page where you have Macross, right? So, page 21. Everyone at home.
Of this book, no one can buy.
Well, you, Gwyn, right. Page 21, in the corner, it says 1982, explanation work in English. And then it's got this very, very small idea of what Macross is and why it was so influential. Well, it's a story about aliens and Zentradi invading the Earth, but it was revolutionary because of mechanic designs and idols and the love triangle, which was revolutionary for the 80s animation at the time. And then there's a comment by Kalmore. Oh, no. And then there's another explanation of Macross, Do You Remember Love? And then it said something like, well, here they changed a few elements around, like, for example, Minmay was already a top idol. But they never mentioned who Minmay was in the first explanation. It just comes out of nowhere.
So much like the exhibit, it presumes you're going into it knowing.
But then you don't need the explanation in the first place, so the whole thing ends up being really half-assed.
Mm.
It's, like, I don't know. It doesn't... I, as a fan, enjoyed it. But what I wanted from this exhibition was to give him a wider audience. And I feel that it wasn't, I don't know, maybe they didn't intend that. I don't know. But I feel that it wasn't enough.
I didn't get the feeling that's what they were intending to do. I thought maybe it was for the fans, and it was a celebration of his design, not him. You know, which is where I think your objections are coming from. Well, misgivings.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I think. Have you ever seen this TV show that was on BS, broadcast satellite, called Anime Giga? Anime Giga is basically a show about anime production, and it's from a few years back, 5 or 6 years ago now. One time they had Itano on as a guest, but one time they had Kawamori. And what was really interesting is that they went into his background. They went to his house, and they looked at his garden. And in his garden, he's got weeds and overgrowth and all this stuff. And they're like, oh, your garden is not very tidy, is it? And he was like, no. I like to have this be a small ecology, a small environment where you can see how these organisms interact in their natural state, and I get all these ideas for my creations from this.
Wow.
Isn't that kind of, like, completely out of left field when you consider robot design?
It is.
I mean, I really wanted to see stuff like that, you know? When he did the symposium, like, this is just before the big Tohoku earthquake, when he did the robot symposium with Sankai Sensei from Cyberdyne, he talked about making... I think I briefly mentioned this on the podcast like a long time ago. He talked about making, how do you say enkaku sousa in English? I forgot. Like remote control, basically. These remote controlled tiny robots that would be the size of bugs. So you can interact with ants and, you know, witness bug society, insect society. Because it's completely different from human society, obviously. But it has its own structure. Right, it has its own forms of communication. That kind of concept is is part and parcel, I think, of everything that under. I mean, I think it's part of what you were saying with the whole, how is it going to work within the confines of this world that we're that this design is going to be a part of, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when he's making something in a fictional world, he has to consider the fictional world's limitations and the fictional world's nature and ecology and environment. And when he's making a product, as in the Aibo, he has to consider, like, how are people going to interact with this product? What is its role within society? I think there's not enough of that here.
Certainly, and most of what I've mentioned of it is stuff he said in person, so it doesn't really count as far as your average visitor to the exhibit is concerned.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm just like over.
All right. Well, you said as a fan you enjoyed it, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the insights.
Right. Well,
in the comments, I read everything.
I think it needed to be better structured. I saw some things I hadn't seen before, although apparently I already have in some books. But even having said that, they were much larger than they are in those books, so it was great to see the close-up, the details.
Yeah.
I wanted maybe a little less Armored Core, but that was content-wise the only real thing I could complain about. I must admit, I thought Kalmori had more of a hand in the Gaimelfs from Escaflowne, so I was expecting some Escaflowne, which I didn't get, but now I know unfair expectations. But overall, I enjoyed it. It was not comprehensive or in any particular order, so it was a mishmash, really, which was a shame. But for me, it was made worth it because, on top of that, you know, of course, I got to meet the man, and that made it, for me, as an experience, he came across as very approachable and friendly, yet you could very much see the way he spoke, just that inner geek that was making paper models of the Thunderbird 2. But his passion for his work, you know, shows through. And the major takeaway I had from all this, and from all this talking we've been doing, was how the more I spoke to him, the more everything connected. You know, from...
because he's the one guy, you know? It's all him.
Right.
That's from, why.
From silhouette designs to, you know, features on Valks, to how CG works, to the influences on his designs, to the things he's held back and then brought into other projects. It just, the more he spoke, the more you see this kind of pattern emerging. And it all clicks, and that was amazing to kind of witness firsthand. And for that alone, for me, that was a great experience.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that if the exhibition itself, by itself, had given that impression of the man, I think it would have succeeded. Agreed. But it's really just a part of that.
Right.
Anyway.
I don't get what they were trying for. I do see that. And of all the things he's designed, you to have this book be so thin, and it's a shame. But I use it quite a bit. I find it as a very handy go-to reference because it does have a lot of, you know, some of his better-known works in there.
What's good about it is that it's thin, but each page has lots of small illustrations, you know? So they could have gone with 100, 200 pages and made each of those illustrations really big, but they didn't, so I guess it's okay.
Right. I mean, I guess coming off the heels of the Okawara exhibit, because the book for that was very comprehensive.
Yeah, because that's what that was.
Right.
Like, very large pages. I mean, very large illustrations on each page.
I would have liked something similar, I admit. But having said that, it was fine for what it was, and I got, you know, something extra out of it. And who knows when we'll get another exhibit. I mean, we've got Miyatake up next, but when will there be another Kawamori? Who knows? It took him this long to get one just for himself.
Yeah, well, this one might move somewhere else, wouldn't it? I'm sure.
I think it could very well move to Tokyo, but if Macross the Museum was any indication, I found the Tokyo iteration was far more cramped and they cut stuff out of it.
Well, then, another trip to Miyagi Prefecture?
Oh, no, I mean, I'm satisfied with what I've got.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But all right, I think we should probably wrap this up. We've been ranting on for well over 2 hours.
Okay. So, you know where to reach us. The address is speakerpod@gmail.com. Please send us all your feedback. We are swamped with feedback. I'm sorry that we can't. We just don't have the time to answer all of the emails that we've been getting. And also, you know, some of the razor blades that we've been getting through the mail as well. Is there anything else that you want to say? Oh, yeah, well, also, we can be reached at macrosworld.com.
Any number of Facebook
iTunes,
groups.
iTunes. So, this has been Tochiro from the boards, and you have been Renato. Oh, wait, is that me? I don't know. Well, I guess we'll find out one day.
We're just silhouettes of ourselves, Renato.
Yeah.
And we're folding out.
We transform.
I transform. What do you want to transform into?
Speaker podcast, folding out. I just want to say, Dia Clone. Delta, Delta.
What's with you and your Delta?
I don't know. I like it now.